speakers who will make presentations one after the other. As the topics are a bit different, the procedure that we will take is that we will first have the first presentation and then an interaction with the audience, and then take the second presentation. So I would like to introduce to you Professor Steve Fuller, who's a professor of sociology at Warwick University in the United Kingdom, but as you will be able to identify from his accent, he's not British, but he originally comes from the United States of America. And he's best known for his work in the field of social epistemology, which addresses normative philosophical questions about organized knowledge by historical and social scientific means. And I'm quite sure he's going to be very controversial, trying to stimulate a lot of discussion, a lot of questions and remarks afterwards. So without any further ado, I would like to ask Steve to take the floor.
Thank you very much. First of all, I want to thank Bastian for inviting me to this. I'm very honored to be here. I'm a very strong believer in the university, and in fact, I'm a strong believer in the university in the Humboldtian sense, as an institution that is unique in its dedication to the integration of teaching and research. And it's in that spirit in which I'm going to be offering my remarks today. You may have noticed in your conference packs there is a flyer for a recent book of mine called The Sociology of Intellectual Life, which follows up on some of the things that I'm going to be talking about here. But also I have included a paper about academic leadership, which has to do with what exactly should be the orientation of vice chancellors, rectors, whatever, presidents of universities, in terms of governing universities as distinctive forms of organization. Because in a sense, that's kind of the theme that I'm trying to drive home here. And it's one of the things that I think is very valuable about what the Magna Carta Observatory is doing. Namely, there's a sense in which the university is being defined as a distinctive kind of organization that cannot just be managed the way in which you would manage any other kind of organization, but has distinctive properties of its own. And I think this is something increasingly important that we have to keep in mind as we're moving into economically difficult times, and where there's a lot of pressure to benchmark university performance in terms of non-university things. Okay, and so then the question becomes, what is a university? What is distinctive about a university? And that's the spirit in which I'm offering my remarks today. And what I want to do, when I pose the question, is academic freedom affordable in a time of economic crisis? Okay, by academic freedom, I mean that as kind of a general term for what is distinctive about the university's mode of knowledge production. I mean, we live in a time, right, that gets called the knowledge society. Right, and there are some, I think, foolish people who think universities benefit from that idea. But what knowledge society merely indicates is the idea that everything in society produces knowledge, and so universities no longer have a monopoly over it. Okay? And what that means is universities have to become very clear about what it is that it provides distinctively in a market where there are other knowledge producers present. Whether we're talking about at the research end, in terms of science parks and R&D divisions of corporations and things of that kind, or in terms of what, at least in the United States, gets increasingly called digital diploma mills, right, where you can have online degree programs without a lot of the inconvenience of actually having to travel to a campus and pay a large amount of tuition. Okay, so there's a sense in which what is distinctive about a university that is to be protected, that is to be advanced, and that is to be marketed as distinctive, that separates it out from all these other competitors in the field in the kind of world we live in, the so-called knowledge society. And that's where I'm coming from here, because I'm interested in protecting the university. Now, in works of mine, not only the work I mentioned earlier, but previous works, I basically define universities in a particular way, which is, you might say, the background context in which I'm speaking. And I have that written here, and that is, universities manufacture knowledge as a public good through the creative destruction of social capital. Okay? That is my definition of what a university does. So the university has a distinctive product. That is to say, knowledge as a public good. Okay? That not knowledge for a client, right? Knowledge, not just knowledge for those who can pay, but knowledge in a sense that it would actually cost more to prevent it from spreading. Right, in the sort of classical economic definition of a public good, right, the idea of a public good is something that if you tried to restrict it, it would actually cost you more than to allow everyone, including the free riders, to have it. And universities are in the business of producing knowledge in that sense. And this is where the relationship between research and teaching becomes very important. Let's start with the business of social capital. Research, in the first instance, is the creation of social capital. Why is that? Well, because, as with most theories of social capital, the way you develop it is by having a kind of network of people with common interests who work together to produce something. And in this case, we're talking about academics who have an idea, right, who want to sort of be ahead of the curve, come up with some kind of new product. But also we have investors of various sorts, from industry, from the state, whatever. And they form a kind of network that promote knowledge in a certain way. And increasingly, research is of that nature. And even in the old days, when there wasn't that much money around, involved in research, it was still the same kind of story, namely that research was an elite activity that only people who had the right amount of connections, money, whatever, were able to do. And so then the question always arose in the case of new research, how do you prevent this from just becoming another way of creating inequality in society? Why is research a good thing? Why isn't it just another way of creating barriers? And this is where the teaching function comes in. Because universities aren't just about research, they are also about teaching. And it's about the idea of distributing this research that has been, probably in all cases, produced under very elite conditions, and distributing that as widely and as far as possible. Now, in the history of the university, of course, this has taken a long time to happen. So initially, you know, increasing the net, as it were, was quite restricted. Maybe 10% of the population of a country actually got the benefit of research that was produced by, let's say, 1/1000th of that. But now, of course, we're expecting, certainly in the Western world, right, 50, 60, 70% of the population to go to university. So there is this idea that whatever kind of research is being produced in a restricted setting initially, there is a mandate, by virtue of being a university, to spread it as widely as possible, and this is where teaching comes in. So in a sense, the most important part of the university is the curriculum committee. Because that is, you know, as we say, you know, in English we have this word, crucible, right? Where you transform research from various fields into a knowledge, form of knowledge, that can be taught to students who, for the most part, are not themselves going to contribute to that form of knowledge, but who nevertheless need to know that form of knowledge in order to advance as citizens in their societies. And that's what a curriculum committee is for, and all the other things that are associated with that. So the idea of simplifying knowledge, right, producing knowledge in a way that people can understand, right, realizing that the way you present something in the classroom is not how you present it when you're writing a peer-reviewed journal article. All of those kinds of differences become very important at this point, and it's part of the distributive function of knowledge that universities are dedicated to. And if you do not have that connection from research into teaching, you are no longer a university. You may have both functions performing in parallel, right? So you can have people who are pure researchers, and you can have people who are pure teachers. But if there isn't this regular transfer from cutting-edge research into teaching in the classroom, you are no longer a university because you are no longer in the business of manufacturing knowledge as a public good. You are in some other business. Perhaps you are in many businesses. But you are no longer in that business, the business of manufacturing knowledge as a public good. Because that requires that new research gets channeled into teaching. Okay? That's the point. That is what a university is. That is what it's for. Okay? Lots of things get called universities. Fine. But I'm just saying, from the standpoint of what, you know, if you want to defend a distinctive organizational form that needs to be justified and evaluated and accounted for in a very distinctive way and cannot just be reduced to its competitors, either on the research side or on the teaching side, this is what a university is. And to be perfectly honest, we really, those of us who work in universities, have not come up with adequate means of evaluating performance of this distinctive type of institution. What we tend to do instead is we assimilate to other institutions. We assimilate to other organizations. Okay, so for example, we were talking about this a little bit last night at dinner, the idea of counting patents. Okay, right, I mean, what is that about exactly from a university standpoint? Okay, it's countable, it's an industry measure, but does it actually serve the function of the university as a distinct institution and organization? And this is the thing that I am defending, and I think it's quite unique, and I think it is the product of a very complicated set of historical circumstances in the West. And, you know, and this is why, in a sense, I'm very honored to be here at Bologna, because we are at the first university in this sense. And I think it's important to be mindful about what distinguishes this particular kind of entity. How much more time do I have at this point? What? A good 10 minutes. Time flies when you're having fun. One of the things that I think is very important here, when we look at the history of the university, what exactly it is that we want to recover about the university as an idea, is two things, I guess, in the short period of time that I have. I was going to say many more things, but I'll say two things here that I think are important. And one of them is what kind of an institution the university is from a legal standpoint. And here I want us to think a little bit about this idea, the universitas, which of course doesn't just translate as university, but at least in English generally translates as corporation, right? The corporate person, right? So we're talking about guilds and churches, right? City-states, right? Those kinds of things would equally be counted as universitates. And what was the idea here? Well, the idea here is you, and this is where Bologna in particular comes in very influentially, because Bologna was a university that was founded by lawyers, and the types of lawyers that were involved in this university were the glossators, right? The people who were reconciling gaps and contradictions that existed within Roman law, typically by coming up with new categories, new concepts that in a sense can harmonize the entire system. And in Roman law, typically, in terms of the kinds of legally recognized entities, there were two types. So you're an individual. How did you get recognized? Well, one was the gens, right? Your family origin. That was kind of your default mode of identity. That was who you were. And it had to do with who your parents were and what class you belonged to and all that. But then there was this other type, and that was the socius, the allies, the comrades, the people you worked with who may come from different classes of society, from different families, but on temporary projects with definite duration. So once the project is over, like the Crusades, for example, you go back to your original gens identity. So those were the two ideas. Now, the universitas created a new kind of idea, and that is the idea that you can acquire an entirely new identity by virtue of participating in a project that is not merely self-interested, like the Socius would be, right? And it's not merely because of your family background, but because it has some kind of point that has a purpose independently of anyone's particular self-interest. And that was what the Universitas was about. So you become, as it were, an official in the corporate entity. That becomes your new identity, your elected identity, your examined identity. That becomes who you are. And what it requires is that the thing that you are actually protecting and advancing is something that goes beyond immediate self-interest. It is something that is worth pursuing in perpetuity, forever. So that you, as it were, are occupying a role that at some point some other person will be occupying. Because the role is part of maintaining that social entity that has an existence that goes on forever. Now, this is an idea I think we take very much for granted with regard to, let's say, how states run, right? How universities, of course, still run. But this is an idea that had to be actively constructed. Now, why was it constructed in the first place in the 11th and 12th centuries in this city? Well, the idea was that neither the Gens nor the Socius actually captured the idea that people could be involved in legally binding ways in a spiritual task. That is to say, a task that goes beyond just immediate self-interest and immediate material benefit. So you think about, for example, we can think about this as at a relatively concrete level with regard to the guilds. Because the guilds were themselves one of these universitates. What are you protecting? What are you promoting with the guild? The trade skill. The trade skill is worth valuing for its own sake, independently of how much money you can make off of it. Right? And there are certain ways in which you apply the skill that is ethically acceptable and other ways that are not. And that is part of what it is to maintain this. And see, what these lawyers here in Bologna were trying to get at with the idea of the universitas was the possibility that you could have legally binding, reasonably concrete ways of protecting things, the values of which we would normally call spiritual, that aren't just completely tied down to particular people's self-interest, but have a kind of longevity that can be improved in their own terms. So, for example, if you think about how skills get improved, how knowledge gets improved, it's never clear who the beneficiaries actually are going to be, right? If you look at the proportion of amount of effort and money and time that people put into doing something versus who actually benefits in the end by it, you cannot just rationalize this in terms of simple cost-benefit analysis to a given individual. It is something that you have to understand in holistic terms over a long period of time. And that is the context in which the universitas was originally justified as a legal entity. Okay? And it seems to me that this is the kind of thing that we should be mindful of when we think about what exactly it is we're defending in the, of the university in this kind of time of economic crisis. Okay? Because there are issues about how do you identify the interest, how do you maintain the activity so that it retains its quality over time, so that many more people than just those who are participating in it or who pay into it can actually benefit from it. And this is something that was built into the original concept of universitas, which I sometimes think we are losing today. How much more time do we have? 5 minutes? Okay, you see, I'm trying to keep to the time here, because I'm sure you have a lot of questions. One thing that I think is very interesting in this regard is if you go beyond Bologna, and you look at the founding of the universities, this is with all due respect to Bologna, of course, we talk about, in the history of knowledge production, we talk usually about Paris and Oxford as, in a way, counterpoints, right? Sort of opposing university foundations, especially in the 13th century, with regard to the rise of knowledge, okay? And this has a lot to do with the difference in terms of the religious orders that were associated with the two universities. Right, and so with Paris, the Dominicans, with Oxford, the Franciscans. Okay, What I want to stress here is not their differences, which I've actually written about and I think are quite interesting, actually. But I want to stress the fact that they are mendicant orders. Okay? Now, I don't know, for those of you who aren't native English speakers, right, mendicants are beggars. Right? They're beggars. That's what they're, you know, if you're a mendicant, you're a beggar. Now, what exactly does this mean, and why was this important in terms of the way in which universities developed? Okay. Well, the mendicant orders put a positive spin on the idea of poverty as being something that is worth pursuing, right? Largely because Jesus was read as having taught this and so forth. Now, this had some very interesting kind of practical consequences. Namely, that if you were a member of the mendicant order, you were not to be beholden to any single source of income. Right? Which included you could not hold property, which is how we normally think about this. And the mendicant order rose within the Catholic Church, largely in opposition to what was seen as the Catholic Church's increasingly secular control over Europe. Right? And the mendicants were saying, no, this is not how you make your way to spirituality. But of course, these people didn't deny the spiritual world existed. Rather, they reoriented themselves to it. Okay? So in other words, multiple sources of income, never being completely dependent on just one income. This is very important in the rise of the universitas, the corporation, as a legal concept. Because basically, one of the characteristics of this legal concept, the universitas, was that it could raise its own funds. Okay? By whatever means it could. And actually, the preferred means of doing it, the preferred means, which was the model of the churches, was to basically have people who had already been trained, let's say had already gotten a degree at a university, realizing the spiritual or intellectual benefit of having done that, wanting to then give money to others to be able to pursue that. The so-called alumni issue, right, in the United States, right, where the original universities in the United States are private and are religiously based and very much enlivened by this concept. Okay? The idea here is that the people who will primarily fund you in the end are all those multiple people out there who have benefited from your instruction and will want to fund others to get involved for the reasons they got involved. And so if you look at these large American universities, especially the old ones, the ones that have actually had a lot of time to develop alumni over centuries now, right, enormous endowments, right, of people who basically trust the university to do what the university does. They are not targeting it to satisfying particular clients necessarily. Of course that kind of research goes on in the United States. I'm not denying that. Of course there's a lot of targeted client-based research in the United States. But what is incredible is the large amounts of money of people who give as a result of having gone through the experience and believing that others should go through it as well. And that is the church model, actually, the missionary model. Okay? And that was the original sense in which the autonomy of the university as an institution was supposed to be maintained. It was going to be self-funding, but not beholden to one funder. Now, the reason why this whole business about, you know, what was in the back of the minds of those medieval guys in the 12th and 13th century was the issue of the madrasas. Okay? Because when one wants to talk about a precedent for the university prior to its introduction in Christendom in Bologna, Paris, Oxford, etc., one talks about the madrasas in the Islamic world, which of course were very numerous, were very important, but they were very typically driven by a particular patron. And if the patron didn't like what was being taught, he just closed down the school. And the school was completely dependent on it, and the school itself had no legal rights. It was very much existing, as it were, at the behest, right, at the pleasure of the patron. And that's why the madrasas, even though they were incredibly numerous, they were throughout the Islamic world, and as you know, the Islamic world was much more advanced than Christendom was for many centuries, even into the early modern period. nevertheless never developed anything like a university system with the kind of coherence and the kind of integration of intergenerational knowledge. The idea that people generation after generation will be learning a body of collective and ever-increasing knowledge. This is what the university enabled it to do through its legal protections as an autonomous, self-funding institution that was not just beholden to one donor, one patron. And again, this is something that I think is worth keeping in mind in the times in which we live. Okay, because I do think we will need to revisit a lot of these kinds of conditions. We need to go back and say, you know, how has it been possible for universities to have existed like Oxford and Paris and Bologna for so many centuries? Very few things of a social nature have existed this long. And here I think it's important to look at the legal terms under which such arrangements are made possible and not to squander that or get rid of that too easily simply because of changing economic conditions. So I'll stop there and open to questions. Okay, thank you very much. Should I sit down or?
Thank you very much, Steve, for this inspiring, controversial input. Where you clearly also made an effort to not only show us your origin in terms of your accent, but also in terms of emotions, why could you call it that?
That's right, the old time religion. Yeah.
Thank you very much for this. I would like to open the debate and encourage you to react, to ask questions, to make counterpoints, to agree on what Steve has said. And I'm again looking for the first one to Florian to get the discussion going.
Should I respond to that? What do you want to do? How do you want to do it? Okay. Okay.
So the question that I'm interested in is how does this passionate defense of the Humboldtian idea take root at a time when it's becoming more and more of a, certainly it's not a minority, it's no longer the universal university model. We know perfectly well that there are others which are strongly defended, like the peer, the collegial university, in other words, the kind of faculty-run university. We know there's a strong university tradition which has grown out of professional concerns with engineering and polytechnics. So that is my first point. My second point is that in Bologna, Europe, we know that the research and teaching universities, which are members of the European University Association, in other words, the sort of key spokesman for university interests, have a minority of the universities in Europe in membership. I think there are something like 1,000, 1,100. We know there are more than 4,000 universities in Europe. My third point I would like to make is therefore, how do you strengthen this research-teaching link, which the course of which you made so effectively, and can it be anything other than state and public authorities which do it, notwithstanding your intervention in the first session this morning?
We take one more and then give you some room for reply and then do the second round.
Two questions. Thank you very much, Steve, for a thoughtful embrace. The first is similar to the last speaker. You described, I think, very eloquently the model of the Humboldtian university linking and teaching research. And you also mentioned that the universities have endured as social institutions for a very long time. Now, the universities today have taken on a much more utilitarian role. Are you suggesting that this utilitarian sense is eroding the original concept, or can it live complementarily with it? My second question is about the ranking of universities, which is becoming very popular these days. And as you know, I think that most ranking depends largely on research outputs. Europe, rightly and correctly, I think, very strongly linked universities in teaching and research, and most of the ranking excludes teaching. Would you like to just comment on the validity and usefulness of ranking?
Okay. Just wait a second here. Okay. With regard to the first speaker from our friend from Greece, it seems the reason why in my talk I stress the legal definition of the universitas is because I do think it is something more than just a bunch of scholars and students who have common interests. Because it's true, like Plato's Academy lasts many centuries, for example. There's something about the legal protection of the institution by virtue of what it is designed to do. And the key thing that I think was very important was this idea that there were activities that were worth being pursued in perpetuity. That is to say, beyond the lifetime of the people who happen to be involved in it or funding it at any given moment. Right, that the activity itself has intrinsic value, and that in a sense the institution is protecting that, and the people who are involved in it at any given moment are kind of like placeholders, right? They're officers, literally, right? They are people who are carrying forward this idea, this task, whether it's a guild or whether it's knowledge, something that one expects is worth producing, worth doing forever. Right, so in a sense, the legal kind of setting for this is one that allows these institutions to exist beyond the self-interest of the people currently involved. I think that's a really major innovation that goes beyond anything of giving degrees or even the actual content. Because it's true, if you were to go to some of these academies that you're talking about in the Greek and Roman world, and you actually looked at what people were doing on a day-to-day basis, it looked a lot like what universities were doing. But I do think the issue is the legal protection, and what exactly are you protecting about the activity? Okay, And I think this is actually, it's this side of it that I think is increasingly relevant for the status of universities today, especially given the importance of autonomy. Because autonomy is fundamentally, it seems to me, a legal concept. What exactly, what kind of autonomy exactly are we protecting, and how are we protecting it exactly? And see, there I think these innovations to Roman law that began here in Bologna are very distinctive and very significant in defining what a university is. It isn't just the content of what people are doing. It's how you protect the enterprise, okay? That's what I would say to the first speaker. To the second speaker from the London School of Economics, I mean, one of the things that that we're in a position now, of course, where almost anything, if a state gives it a license, could call itself a university. And what that ends up doing, of course, is making arguments to the effect that, well, you know, the Humboldtian model of the university is just one model, and we've got all these other things floating around that are called universities, too. And aren't they universities? I mean, the government says it is. Okay? And I do think this is where I think an organization like this, which I take it stands for a concept rather than for a word, right? What is the concept that it stands for here? And I do think that it's very important that if an institution calls itself a university, there should be some basic requirements that are being met by it, other than the fact that the government gives it that name. Okay? And there I do think that the integration of teaching and research and the idea of making knowledge a public good as at least one of the functions of the institution is a minimal requirement. Okay? And if the institution isn't doing that to at least a certain extent of its activities, it is not properly a university. And I would have thought an organization like this could stand on that principle and leverage and as it were impose influence that way. So this is kind of, it seems to me, what I'm doing is, yes, I am defending a concept. I'm not defending some statistical generalization about everything that happens to be called a university today. I'm defending a concept which I think is quite distinctive and is not one that can be reduced to the current market competitors for universities in today's world. It's a very distinctive kind of idea. Now, the question you then ask is, what's the value of this idea? You know, in the sort of economic times in which we live and so forth. Well, I do think one thing we need to keep in mind, right, and this is something I think Humboldt, because look, if you look at the original papers that Humboldt filed when he was Minister of Education with regard to rechartering the University of Berlin, he definitely thought that having this kind of conception of the university was actually in the best long-term economic and political interest of Prussia. Okay? He didn't think that, he wasn't just justifying, you know, in other words, you have a lot of people spreading knowledge as widely as possible at a basic research level because actually in the long term that will benefit you practically. In other words, it's a kind of blue skies argument for long-term practical impact. And in a sense, that's how universities justify themselves. In particular, if you're thinking about it, that your main audience in a university is the next generation of leaders in your society. What do you want the next generation to know? If you've got a monopoly over nothing else, you've got a monopoly over that. The next generation of your leaders. And that's what Humboldt was thinking about. And so the issue isn't, you know, training people for immediate skills and so forth, but training for people who are going to be spending 50 years of their lives as the leaders of their society, regardless of what field they're in from a technical vocational standpoint. Moreover, we are living at a time now where the life expectancy of any job that a person has is 5 years. So you train somebody in a skill and you're obsolete. But if you train somebody in forms of knowledge that will be useful for them throughout their entire life because they tap into deeper principles and bigger ideas, then you're doing something distinctive. Okay, and I think that's the point. You know, what do we mean when we say doing something practical here? We live in a world that from a practical standpoint, people have to be changing their jobs every 5 years. So how practical is it to tell somebody to just specialize in one form of vocational training? How practical is that when it gets down to it? No, what's practical is to think in terms of a long term in which the world is always changing and you have got to be prepared for that changing. You have to have the mental flexibility and the intelligence to do that. And that gets us back to very traditional ideas of liberal arts and all these things that are traditionally associated with the university. Okay? So I don't think this is not divorced from the practical at all. This is very much in terms of the practical, but the practical does not mean short term. The practical need not be myopic. There is the long term to consider. Especially, I would say, in countries where the increase in universities and university populations are being used to boost the nation in the long term. Which is what Humboldt was doing, because Humboldt is playing catch up, right? Prussia is catching up with France and England in the early 19th century. That was the context in which this new university got established. It was a competitive move from a country that was behind. Okay? And I think for those of you who are thinking about using universities to boost your nations in terms of long-term competitiveness, Humboldt's model is worth going back to in its detail. Okay? Now, finally, in terms of the rankings and the use of metrics and so forth for evaluating universities, I mean, the problem here is we tend to count what is most easily countable. That's always been the case. And the problem is that the people who kind of realize or would accept the kinds of critiques that I'm saying, namely, we don't really evaluate properly the relationship between teaching and research, these people do not tend to have any belief in quantitative approaches. They tend to be these qualitative people, right? People, you know, they tend to be people who think you can't measure this stuff. And that's not an appropriate answer. That is not an appropriate answer. What we actually need are quantitatively literate people actually trying to come up with sophisticated metrics that try to show exactly the impact of research on teaching and the result of the teaching in terms of what the students are able to do in the population at large. In other words, the value added that comes from the training that otherwise would not be present in the economy or the society had that training not occurred. We need some very sophisticated economic modeling of this, of what you might call, you know, we're talking so nicely about Keynes, like the multiplier effects of education. And chart those things out. And again, it's long-term modeling, long-term measures. They're not going to be easy. It's not going to be simple counting of patents or citation counts or anything like that. But it can be measured, it seems to me. And it seems to me that's something that there should be a lot of effort spent on. I'm sorry for going on so long.
Might have a new role, and that is a clearing house for knowledge
produced in all over the societal organization.
That's right.
Now, I have three points here. How does this effectively happen, or how it should happen in the future? How does this impact on the whole cooperation versus competition of institutions debate? And what is the role of the academic community with a particular focus, of course, on students?
Thank you. Okay, there's a lot here on the table. I assume this is the last round, right? Okay, the first point, what I guess was the question that was raised from you, I guess, about the what might be tensions between the university's autonomy and civil society. It seems to me that there don't need to be any kinds of conflicts here. I think where the conflicts arise is where people, you know, industry, whatever, want to put restrictions on the distribution of knowledge for financial reasons. Okay? I do think there's another kind of issue as well, and that is, and we really haven't spoken about this at the conference. So beyond the fact that, you know, the intellectual property problems, in a sense, intellectual property can potentially prevent universities from spreading knowledge. Okay, so it undermines the Humboldtian mission in that sense. But there is also a kind of internal problem, and that has a lot to do with the way academics are trained. We haven't really spoken about that, and especially if you're being trained to become an academic. Right, one of the things you typically are not trained in is how to teach or how to communicate with people beyond your narrow specialty group. And insofar as academics are increasingly evaluated in terms of how their peers in their own specialties regard them, there is really no incentive, actually, on the part of professional academics to be able to reach out. They don't get rewarded for it. There is no incentive for it. And it seems to me that is a real big mistake, and that really does undermine, as it were, what I would regard as a very Humboldtian idea of actually an outreach from the university to the larger civil society. The idea of public lectures, the idea of professors writing in newspapers, things of that kind. I know that still happens in certain countries, but there is no incentive to do it in the Anglo-American world, that's for sure. Okay? I mean, you do it on your own time, but it's not considered to be part of your proper academic work, and you are never trained to be able to communicate that. In fact, the way you communicate in the classroom typically is by enforcing the authority of your discipline. So in other words, you make the knowledge that you're presenting as foreign, as alien as possible to the student. Really. And I think that's a big mistake, and that is a real big obstacle for the knowledge from the university getting out to the larger society. Now, in the issue of the teaching, let's see if I get this right. I think one of the things that would be very useful to do, I mean, let me start back a little bit. In 1990, the Carnegie Foundation in the United States commissioned a report called Scholarship Reconsidered, which some of you may know about. And one of the things that it argued was that, in fact, we need to broaden our notion of what scholarship is. So it isn't just publishing research in peer-reviewed publications, but it could also involve people going to conferences for purposes of learning things and participating in events that enable them to enhance their teaching. Right? So in other words, the primary beneficiary of one's scholarly work need not be one's colleagues, but could be students. Now, how would you measure this? Well, you would look at the way in which course outlines, you know, syllabus, you know, the curricular materials. I mean, this is where going back to how the curriculum is constructed is a very important part of what a university is. It's why I regard it as kind of the heart and soul of the university. To what extent is the curriculum being improved in light of exposure to new ideas and things that are coming in? And so in that respect, we need to kind of get more serious about that. Another issue that was raised was also the business about the cooperation and competition of institutions. I have nothing against competition as long as we're competing against the right things. And I think one of the problems, this is where I brought up this issue at the beginning about what the knowledge society means. The knowledge society basically means that universities are now thrown into markets where they are competing against, in many cases, non-university organizations. Right? For the provision of both research and teaching, typically by separate organizations who can serve the client base each more efficiently than the university can if the client has a very narrow conception of what their interest is. Okay? And it seems to me that's the big problem. It's that kind of competition that's a problem. But if we're talking about just universities competing against other universities for things that universities are for, I don't have a problem with that. But I don't think that's actually the sense of competition we normally face now. Okay, we're competing against non-university organizations. The point was also raised about where I am on open education and the internet and all that kind of stuff. I'm very much in favor of that. I don't think you can stop it, but I also don't think universities necessarily have to be capturing that market. It seems to me that historically, here's my analogy, okay? How do you understand this phenomenon historically? Well, in the 19th century in England, once you started to get the rise of a lot of independent primary and secondary schools, because you know, back in the old days, before 1800, people would enter university when they were teenagers, often in their very early teens. And what you start to see in the 19th century is you start to see primary schools, secondary schools, right, kind of in between, kind of capturing a certain kind of market there. Well, one of the things that Oxford and Cambridge did was they didn't get into that business. What they did was they became accreditors. In other words, they were the ones who basically evaluated all these new institutions that were arising, all these primary and secondary schools, and saying what was good and what was bad about them, and why people who are going to be teaching in those institutions ought to take degrees with them first. So if you're going to be a teacher in a primary secondary school, you should get a degree from Oxford and Cambridge. Similarly, if you're going to be running some kind of online, internet-based learning thing, right, the idea of having proper universities accredit the curricula of those places, and as it were, you know, making it necessary or at least creating a big fuss that one ought to be, you know, have degrees and be evaluated by universities before being licensed to teach in such places. It seems to me that's the way in which universities can maintain their advantage in that kind of new market. They basically have to be evaluators, not direct competitors, but evaluators of these new forms of research and teaching provision. That, I think, is what history would show. Because if you go down the route of competing directly, I don't think you can win because universities are doing too many things at once. And they're never going to be as lean and mean as the University of Phoenix in the United States. But you shouldn't have to be competing with them, but you should be in a position of evaluating them and saying what's a good and bad program and publicizing that information. So you become the body that keeps the standards for those other new forms of knowledge provision that are arising. And then the university, it seems to me, can keep its autonomy. Finally, the state provision stuff, and I'll end there. I'm very mixed on this, okay? When the state, in the glory days, you might say, of the welfare state, when there was this great public support for universities, and the universities were allowed to pretty much run themselves and so forth, the understanding was that only 10 or 20% of the population would actually be going to university, but that from that small number, you would end up getting benefits that maybe one or two generations later will benefit all of society. And that's how you could justify all the taxpayers, even if they never went to university, paying money into an elite, what was effectively an elite university system. Because you had this kind of, again, a kind of multiplier effect kind of conception that in the long run, investing some money now in a university will, a generation or two down, even if only a few people are funded, they will produce cures for diseases, they will improve the workplace, industrial technology, whatever, that will benefit everyone. That was the original belief. The problem arose when the state started to believe that universities were things that everybody had to go to just to get a job. Okay, when universities became credentials mills, right, where in a sense it became a way of, you know, just becoming certified to be able to perform a job, and then you immediately over a generation boosted the participation in higher education from 10 and 20% to 40 to 60%, that was when the problem started. Because then people evaluated universities differently, and the tax burden became higher. And people said, well, look, you know, what am I paying for here? I'm paying for all of these students to go to university. Well, what am I getting for it? It now costs 2, 3, 4 times more than it did before. I want the benefits more quickly. Okay, and so people's orientation about the relationship between the costs they were paying and the benefits they were paying changed once you started to expand the number of people who were entering into the public in publicly supported education. And I think that's where we found we're in a problem we are now, especially in Europe. And as a result, right, we're now very quickly moving to a more highly privatized system, which I think is disastrous. But I think that's how we got into this problem in the first place, is that when people started to think that you needed a university degree to get a fairly ordinary job, you see, that was when the mistake was first made. But I know it's a very unpopular thing to say. But I do think that that was kind of where the problem got started, from the standpoint of state supporting of education and maintaining the autonomy of the university. And I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Steve. Let's give him a big round of applause.